Welcome to Versus History with Elliot Watson and Patrick O'Shaughnessy.
Good afternoon and welcome to Versus History. I'm Dr. Elliot L. Watson, and with me, as has been recently the case, is...
It's me, it's Connell Smith at Prehistoric Man back, but we've got the whole gang back together today. Who've we got?
Well, we have...
Drumroll, please, it's me. I'm back in the room. History chappy, Patrick O'Shaughnessy. I've missed you guys. You've missed me too, you guys.
We haven't missed your silly bow ties. No. Welcome back, Pat.
It's great. Fatherhood's treating me well. History's treating me better. And it's just good to be in your company.
Yeah. We had a good time with that, Emily, didn't
we? Yeah, we did. But, you know.
All good things come to an end.
Yeah. Okay. So you're back. And at this point, this juncture, what you normally do, Pat, is you give us an overview, a bit of an appraisal of our listeners, how many listeners we have, how many followers we have on Twitter and Instagram and all that kind of stuff. Why don't you do that again?
Boom. Okay. We're doing very well on Twitter. Thank you to everyone that continues to follow. We really appreciate it. We're on the cusp of 700. 699. So thank you very much indeed. Dedicate, Educate, Mr. Jones, North Mon History Department, David Tollan, Sarah McGuinness, Ruby Clift, Campion History, Jeff Emerson, Mike Collier, Zoe Yaya, Lawrence Baxter, Miss B. Special shout out to Zoe Yaya, who got in touch with the editors via Twitter saying that her class had utilised the podcast on Weimar Germany as part of their learning process, and that makes us feel really good. Thank you very much indeed. Makes it all worthwhile.
It does indeed. Now, with that in mind, we do like our teachers and our students to get in touch and say if they use Versus History in the classroom. And we might have something special for our listeners, particularly our teacher listeners, at the end of the show.
I was going to ask you about what you're wearing, Elliot. What are you sporting?
I'm sporting a rather fetching T-shirt that has Versus History written across the front. And it looks magical. On you as well, Connell.
It does, but I see Patrick's looks a little snug.
Well, yeah. I like to say Mr. Smith's is the Versus History leotard, the paint-on version.
It looks a little bit like he's wearing a baby T-shirt, but yours is an extra, extra large, and it still...
Fits me nicely, moving on.
It seems to be stretching in places it shouldn't be stretching.
Burgeoning with knowledge.
Absolutely, why not? Right, okay, so let's move over to Connell. Connell, what are we going to do today?
So today we're going to talk about the German economy, so the economy under the Nazis. This is going to be split into two parts. Today we're going to look at what was kind of one of the priorities of the Nazis, if not the priority, when they came in 1933. They're in a position where there are 6 million unemployed. I think you're going to tell us a little bit about why we're in that position. We're looking today at the economy in Nazi Germany, and particularly employment, what it's like to be employed, what levels of employment are like. So I think it would be good for us to bring the listeners up to speed and set a bit of context. So Elliot, do you want to take us through why we're facing unemployment in 1933?
Sure, it makes perfect sense. There's no point dropping the listener in 1933 and saying, listen, here are the problems. Let's take us back a little bit and see where those problems come from, and then we're going to get into the argument which relates to how Hitler and the Nazis dealt with those problems. So I'm going to take you all the way back to the end of World War I. Throughout the 1920s, Weimar Germany slowly stabilised many areas of its economic infrastructure after the turmoil of the immediate post-war period of 1918-23. Gustav Stresemann, Germany's foreign minister, was able to bring Germany back from the brink of collapse under the pressures of hyperinflation, reparations payments, and the continuing burdens of World War I spending. It was during this period of what I like to say to my students of relative stability, often termed the Golden Years or the Stresemann era, that the National Socialists were unable to gain much of a foothold with the German electorate. However, once the Wall Street crash and the Great Depression pushes Germany over the brink and into dire economic straits, the Nazis were able to generate a greater level of support. They were able to do this, in part, by blaming the Weimar government for its failure to solve the economic problems confronting Germany. And so it was that in January 1933, when Hitler was appointed Chancellor by Paul von Hindenburg, he surveyed the economic landscape of Germany and prioritized unemployment as his primary concern. If unemployment, with all of its associated consequences, could bring down one government, it could bring down another, his own. Now, I know Connell right now has a very interesting quote that kind of sums up Hitler's approach to employment.
Hitler said when he came to power that history will judge us according to whether we have succeeded in providing work. And he was probably wrong. The Nazis have probably been judged using other things, but certainly today, versus history will judge him according to whether he succeeded in providing work. So for this, as usual on Versus History, we're going to have two sides. For the proposition suggesting the Nazis solved unemployment or made lots of progress, we have got Elliot.
Yes, that's
and
me.
Then arguing that actually unemployment wasn't really solved by Nazis, we have got Patrick, and that leaves me stuck in the middle as the referee, trying to keep you apart, stop you from landing too many fatal blows on one another. So, it makes sense, as usual in Versus History, to build something up before we knock it down. So, let's hear the argument that the Nazis solved unemployment and were very successful in that area. So,
right.
Back to you again, Elliot.
Okay, so listen, I'm going to keep this very short, this part very short and very sweet. In 1933, when Hitler becomes Chancellor, in January 1933, he is faced with a gargantuan problem. The gargantuan problem is we have 6 million people in Germany. That's over 30% of the total German workforce unemployed. Jump forward 6 years, so by 1939, unemployment stands at a mere 0.9% of the available workforce. Now, that by any measure seems to be, at least on the surface, a very successful attack on, or a war on, which is what he calls it, on unemployment. It's infinitely superior to countries such as Denmark, Great Britain, Canada, the Netherlands, Norway, Sweden, Australia, and Belgium. I could go on. So in that period of time, in 1939, Nazi Germany is streets ahead at reducing unemployment as caused by, in part, the Wall Street crash and the Great Depression. Okay, Pat, you've got to jump in there.
Yeah, of course. I'm going to delineate some criteria, if I may. I think it's important that we root everything we do, because our students are going to have to do the same thing, in solid criteria. So I'm going to set up some criteria for myself. You're under no obligation to utilise them, though. Was he successful and was he effective? Now, students might think that they're one of the same. I'm going to contend that they're not for the purpose of this debate. I'm going to contend that in terms of quantity, in terms of the numbers, in terms of the balance sheet, Hitler was quite successful because it looks like unemployment is going down. And that was successful for Hitler because he certainly reaped the propaganda rewards from it. But was he effective qualitatively? Not really. Essentially, Hitler's progress is largely due to the fact that he skews the figures. Women are excluded from them. Jews are excluded from them. Much of the work that is created is short-term and funded by something called MIFO bills, borrowing. This is government jobs given in the short term. There is nothing long-lasting or qualitative about it. Just for our listeners, in 2018, when prime ministers, presidents and governments talk about unemployment and employment, they'll talk about the living wage, a high standard of employment, fulfilling employment. Much of the jobs given by the Nazis doesn't really fit that criteria. I would definitely suggest that Hitler was successful in terms of massaging his own ego and making the Nazi party look good. He was definitely successful in moving the debate away from unemployment, because he says in 1936, we've won that battle, let's move on. But was it effective? Not really in providing long-term sustained employment.
So to get things straight, you're not saying that Nazi policies to tackle unemployment are a failure, but that Germans lose out from them, or they don't benefit very well from them.
Can I also add in, America was doing something quite similar in the time of the 1930s with the New Deal. Huge state-centric employment, obviously without the Nazi twist. If we jump over the Atlantic to Britain, they were doing not a lot in the 1930s, really. So it wasn't unparalleled. This is huge state intervention on behalf of Hitler.
Go on, sorry.
Absolutely. The historian Rich Overy says that the policies actually pursued in 1933 had much in common with those adopted in other countries and with the policies of the pre-Hitler government. So I think in that sense, some historiography would back you up on that point, Patrick. Elliot, you look like you want to jump in.
Yeah, I want to jump in because I think he's talking about the comparisons with the New Deal spending in the United States and in Britain. But we haven't actually outlined what the policies were that Hitler and the Nazis followed anyway. So I think we need to jump back a little bit before we start looking at those kind of comparisons, because I think those comparisons are absolutely of value. Hitler's strategy was massive governmental spending, what they called the Arbeitsschlacht, or the battle for work. This was his main goal, to end unemployment. Huge public work schemes. And the Reinhardt Plan, which was approved in June 1933, provided 1 billion Reichsmarks for the improved infrastructure projects. Most significantly, the Reichsautobahn project led by Fritz Todt. Other projects such as the Reichsbahn, the railway systems, and the Reichspost, the postal service, were also undertaken. Now, what he was very clear about, and what, as you quite rightly pointed out, other countries were very clear about as well, was that in the depths of depression, it was important for the government to spend. It was important for the government to provide employment. And that's exactly what the Nazis did. The huge Autobahn building scheme was very, very similar to the Tennessee Valley spending schemes in the United States, where they built the dams and all of this kind of stuff. But I'm just going to pick you up on something you mentioned earlier. You mentioned that much of the economic or the policies to control unemployment were very short term, and I'm going to concede that to you later. You mentioned that much of it was funded by these MIFO bills, but what I would say to you is this: after the consolidation of power in the period 33 to 34, Hjalmar Schacht becomes the Minister of Economics and introduces the new plan. And he is quite happy to run a trade deficit in favour of importing raw materials that, according to Reich Erich Malema, he says this, the processing of which in turn created a greater domestic need for labour. The short-term effect of the strategy was full employment by 1939. So actually running a trade deficit is not something that is a concern at this point in Nazi Germany, and it certainly wasn't a concern in many other parts of the world who were deficit spending at the same time. But the question is, did it benefit the unemployed? And the answer is unequivocally yes.
Okay, can I come over to some historiography? Just want to outline the context. This is from Richard Evans in his book, The Third Reich in Power. This actually supports your point. After 1936, Hitler and the leading Nazis did not trouble to mention the battle for work again. The fact that it had been won had long since been accepted by the overwhelming majority of the German people. Now, in terms of figures, that looks like it's the case, because in 1936, there was just 1.6 million people unemployed, whereas way back in the depths of depression in 1932, there were 5.6 million people unemployed. Now let's go with the quantity. Let's go with the amount of people unemployed. It all depends how we tot up the figures, ladies and gentlemen. If we exclude Jewish people on the basis of the fact that they are Jewish from unemployment figures, in terms of the figures, it makes the figures look better, because Jewish people will leave their roles and they will free them up, for which means the unemployment figures go down.
I'm just going to inject there. How many Jews of working age? We're only talking about a matter of maybe 100,000. So in the larger context of the 6 million, how far does that 100,000 really impact?
But we also need to factor in the fact that Jewish people are now being encouraged to migrate away, and would be considering migrating away given the heightened pressure of Nazi oppression. So we also need to consider the fact that Jewish people are being made to feel very unwelcome in their own land. The Civil Service Law of 1933 started to remove them from government jobs. So I think we need to look wider at the fact that it wasn't just Nazis literally kicking people out of jobs, it was they were forcefully encouraging Jews to move out of the country.
And sure, also it's important for us to note, it's obviously not only Jewish people who don't count towards these statistics.
Okay.
So
yep.
Other people who don't count, married women who give up work to get married,
yes.
People in concentration camps, they don't count as being unemployed. So there are a number of categories of people that the Nazis are choosing to exclude from their figures.
Exactly that.
Were we to include those people, though, I think the figures... overall unemployment would still have gone down.
Without a shadow of a doubt.
I contend that.
The only other thing I want to contend at this point in terms of quantity, the new Reich Labour Service forced all young men between the ages of 19 and 25 to undertake manual labour,
yeah.
Which was unpaid. So essentially, they didn't count on the unemployment register, but they weren't being paid either. This suited Hitler, because he could get these young men in a uniform undertaking Nazi-style marching songs. Essentially, this was a incubator for the armed forces, where essentially this is going to go. Because in 1935, we're going to see the massive growth of the German armed forces, which further soothes unemployment. Now, that's going to be paid for in the long term by invading other countries. So this all comes down to terms of quantity, how we tot up the facts, figures and statistics. If we exclude people, then obviously it's going to look better. But look better it did, and I think the majority of Germans accepted that.
Yes, can I just jump in for a second? You're absolutely right. Jews were taken out, women were taken out, and work shy, quote unquote, were taken out of the statistics, the unemployment statistics. And a lot of people do see the Nazi success in reducing unemployment as something of a bookkeeping piece of magic. And in a sense, you know, you have to acknowledge that some of that is true. But we also have to acknowledge this. I've got a statistic for you. In 1936, so this is a year after Goering's four-year plan, unemployment falls from 12% to 6.9%. This is 3 years after much of what you were talking about has already happened. So women have already been taken out. The work shy are in the process of being taken out. And after the Nuremberg laws of 35, many of the Jewish population have been taken out as well. But we still see nearly a 50% drop in that percentage of unemployed.
Absolutely. And what's the motor for that in 1935, 1936? Rearmament. The fact that the Nazis are saying that they're going to rearm. So
precisely.
So you're absolutely right that we have a fall in unemployment there, but it's something that the Nazis can directly control. They can just channel 1.3 million extra people into the army by 1939, which, you know, out of our statistic of 6 million unemployed at the start, is nearly a quarter just from that one source of employment.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I just want to get back, because we're talking about quantity, and this is the last thing I'm going to say on quantity. Pat, you mentioned earlier this idea, or not this idea, the reality that many of these people, many of German men between the age of 18 to 25 were forced to work, and they were forced to do so unpaid in what is called the RAD, which is the National Labour Service, or the Reicharbeitsdienst. Now, we have to remember that, yeah, unpaid technically, in a sense that they didn't receive a wage, but they did receive what you might consider pocket money. And whilst a lot of people moaned, obviously, at the lack of, or the amount of money they were being paid, the majority of Germans were still glad to get secure and fairly safe employment and activity. It was better than nothing, despite the fact that what they were being paid was, or what they were receiving was, what you might consider pocket money. Right, over to you again, Pat.
Yeah, I think that it's the Hitler conundrum. I think he's actually very, very pleased with the unemployment situation when he takes power in January 1933, because there's a problem for him to fix. There's lots of unhappy people marauding the streets with no money in their pockets,
yeah,
who are feeling lost. Hitler's going to provide his Nazified salvation. He's going to get men in uniforms. He's going to reintroduce compulsory conscription from 1935. And as we've mentioned, the Reich Labour Service. So he's going to present himself as almost the saviour of this problem that he has been gifted with, which seems quite perverse, because unemployment for Roosevelt was no gift, and unemployment for the British government was no gift either. But I think Hitler actually relishes in this. I've got a quote here from, actually, the Nazis themselves. It says, "Just a minute, ladies and gentlemen. Here's something you ought to know. In January 33, there were 11.5 million employed. In 1936, there are 15.7 million. All the Führer's work. That's all you need to know."
Huh.
So I think that highlights the fact that the Nazis were looking at this in a quantitative fashion, the amount of people. Doesn't matter what they were doing, how much they were getting paid. And this is actually glee for Hitler, because he's rubbing his hands together. They're all being Nazified in the process.
Absolutely.
And not being paid much. So that's why I contend he was definitely successful in terms of massaging his ego and for a propaganda coup for the Nazi party. But effective in the long term, probably not.
I don't think we can really stretch into the long term, because we never get that far, do we?
No, Hitler's long term goal, he's going to pay for all this by invading other countries and exploiting their resources.
And so, of course, we know how all of that ends, so we can never really say. But, okay, so, quantitatively, what are you saying?
He was a success.
That's my argument.
He was a success, quantitatively.
Sure, that's my
it's
argument.
It's always nice to have unity in mind.
It's a success in his own balance book, because he topped up the balance book. He sets the criteria for what denotes an unemployed person. And
yes,
if you're going to exclude Jewish people, women, undesirables, then it's always going to look good. And if you're going to make people unemployed do stuff for free and take them off the balance book, then it's always going to look better.
So in what context should we consider it a failure then?
We should consider it a failure in providing a long-term solution to an entrenched problem. But I think we got to, you know, skip back to America. A lot of the jobs that were created by the Civilian Conservation Corps were temporal, fleeting, and didn't do much more than get men to go and dig roads and build bridges and help in parks. And in Britain, they weren't doing much at all because they couldn't.
Yeah.
Is that not the only way to solve an unemployment problem, to create work, which by its own nature is not pointless, but the end is providing employment rather than anything else, sort of economic growth.
The key difference is going to be shooting into the long term. The Americans are going to look to this to basically become self-sustaining in the long term. The Nazis, it's not going to be self-sustaining because they're just going to nick and steal and plunder other people's stuff. So I think that's how the Nazis see the way out of it.
Perfect. I think Elliot, did you want to come back on that?
I was just going to mention something we don't really like on here, something counterfactual, because it's very difficult to say their thinking was short term, but I would contend it wasn't, because in the long term their view was to the creation of Lebensraum. It was autarky through the conquering of other countries. Autarky meaning self-sufficiency in terms of economics and trade. So I think it would be a very different outcome had the Nazis won, because we would, well, obviously we probably wouldn't be sitting here, but somebody would be sitting here saying, look how successful they had been. But the loss, obviously, in World War II nullifies any argument that in the long term, or that they were thinking long term.
Very much so.
A good point.
Okay, that's fine.
A good point. Well,
shall I come back to my criteria
that I
very handily set up for myself?
Yeah.
Was Hitler successful in making himself and the Nazi party look good off the back of the unemployment issue which he inherited? Absolutely. The fact that he considered the job done by 36, and the majority of German people did, must indicate that to a very large extent they were successful. Were they effective? Well, it's going to depend how you denote and break down effective. Yes, he was effective in getting young men into Nazi uniforms. He was effective in getting Jewish people out of the professions and women out of jobs so they could become wives and mothers and the future mothers of the Third Reich. So was he effective in that sense? Yes. But was he effective in the sort of traditional sense that maybe we would look at it, or the modern sense, in providing long-term employment that adds value, that delivers well-being and a living wage? I would suggest much less so.
By your own criteria, it seems to me you just said the same thing. You just restated the same thing, that the figures, people had been taken out of the figures. I don't see, we're still talking quantitatively. I think if we're talking qualitatively, him looking good, or the Nazis looking good on the back of unemployment or employment statistics, I would say that's what all politicians do. That's what all governments do. If they do well, they celebrate it and they get the plaudits. So I don't see how that's any different.
The key difference here, you had no vehicle to voice your discontent in Nazi Germany,
right,
given the police state. So I think if we're going to look for opposition as a barometer of success or failure, we're going to struggle with the Nazis, because none was permitted. You'd be shipped off to Dachau and never seen again, or whisked away by the Gestapo. So that's a really difficult one. But over to you.
Okay, right. Well, I think we should probably draw things to a close.
Bring it to a close already? Why is that?
Well, I think that if we go any further, we're going to kind of open a whole can of worms about standard of living, strength through joy, beauty of labour, etc.
They sound like three separate podcasts.
They do! So why don't we draw things to a little close on that, and maybe save all of those things for next week. So actually the quality of life, what it was like for your ordinary German to be working under the Nazis or under the Nazi economy, until next week. Sound
Fair
like
enough.
A good idea?
Yeah, it sounds like you've let Patrick off easy though.
That sounds good. Could we just whack in very quickly what we actually think? Would that be okay?
Go on,
that
then.
Would be good.
Why don't you start off, Connell?
So I think that you're right, Elliot, in terms of the numbers go down and the numbers look good. The Nazis are dealing with unemployment seemingly effectively, but I think we also need to take into the wider context, there is a lot to be said for the fact that the Great Depression is actually bottoming out in 1932. And so the Nazis are taking advantage of that situation. They're helped by other factors, but their own policies do clearly reduce unemployment significantly. And for the masses of people who are unemployed in Germany, some employment, even if it's not that well paid, is better than no employment at all.
Well, really, it's just a mix, isn't it? You have to concede that a great many people were taken out of the unemployment statistics or the employment statistics. And so because that cannot be discounted, it's almost impossible to say they were successful without the caveat of that. They did reduce unemployment quite dramatically, but the drama is really is exacerbated. It's accentuated by the fact that they've taken so many people out. But by 1939, you've got 0.9% of the working population unemployed. That's unemployed, right?
Unemployed.
Right. You know, so it has to be a mix. You have to look at it from both sides. What do you think?
Yeah, I think if we were in 1930s Germany, we would look at this as a bona fide success for the Nazis. We would look at it and say the Nazis have reduced unemployment. They said they were going to, and they have.
Yeah.
And that's pretty important because that's how people at the time in that context saw it.
And I think you're right to say success for the Nazis.
Yes.
What we can talk about next week is to what extent does success for the Nazis equal success for the workers.
I like
but thinking. in terms of that, absolutely, success for the Nazis. So let's end that there. Let's cut that off. Let's tide that over till next week. And
right.
Shall we talk about how our listeners can get their hands on one of these T-shirts?
Right. Well, we're going to open this up more next week. So what we have is we have a number of T-shirts that we've had specially printed, beautiful looking things that we're going to put on Twitter and there are other social media platforms to show you what they look like. And we're going to offer a very limited number of these for free to certain people who, well, let's just say, do something for us.
Let's say if you prove to us on Twitter that you and your students are using it in a classroom somewhere on planet Earth.
Using what in a classroom?
Versus History, either our PDFs or our debates, anything. Anything to do with Versus History, our website. If you show us aesthetically in a picture of you using something to do with Versus History, we might give you a T-shirt.
Yeah,
and I like the word might.
Might. you have to either email us at historyversus@gmail.com or contact us through our website, www.versushistory.com, or tweet us at @versushistory or Instagram us at @versushistory and show us some kind of picture. We'll pick how many out of a hat?
I'm feeling generous. Whatever you're going to say, I'm going to add one more on. Were you going to say two?
Not too generous.
I was going to say maybe we'll cut a sleeve off and give a sleeve away. 10.
Oh, you generous man.
Well, you've got to go to 11 now, Patrick.
Let's see.
He's turning it up to 11.
I tell you what we'll say. The more you're using it, the more stuff we'll give you. The more impressive the photo looks, the more likely we are to be generous. I'll be more generous than Connell, but Connell will be more generous than Elliot. So there you go. Just tweet us, get it to us, and we'll give you some stuff back. Maybe.
Maybe. Okay, so I think we'll draw this to a close. It has been fantastic, as it always is. It's brilliant to have you back again, Pat. Now you're going to go home to a screaming, crying wife. Oh, no, baby. And I'll be going home to my kids, and Connell's going to be going home to his baby. So it is goodbye from me.
Goodbye from me.
Goodbye from me.
And goodbye from Versus History.
Versus History. See you later. Bye-bye.
Thank you for downloading and listening to this edition of Versus History. Subscribe, visit us at our website, www.versushistory.com.